Chapter 15. The Red Fox. Lieutenant Colonel Willie Todd would never again lead his men in battle, but he would do whatever was necessary to lead them home. Todd was the embodiment of Colditz itself. Tall, greying, battle-battered, and as tough as granite. The senior British officer was a Scotsman with a long equine face and an extravagantly broken nose. Peace-loving, courteous and gentle, he was quite different in character from earlier SBOs. Todd disapproved of goon-baiting, which he considered bad sportsmanship. "The Germans were taking a licking," wrote Padre Platt. He did not believe in kicking a man when he was down. Todd did not actively inhibit escaping, but as the risks mounted and the end of the war inched closer, he did not encourage it either. The escape committee continued to function, but he would only approve future attempts if they provided a real chance of success. For most prisoners, that half-prohibition came as a relief. Adored and revered by the younger men, old Wally wore his own sadness on the inside. In January 1944, a few months after Todd arrived in Colditz, his son and only child was killed fighting in Italy. He did not tell a soul, and when word leaked out and his fellow prisoners offered condolences, Willie Todd simply gazed into the distance and said, "It happens to soldiers." But he was utterly determined to make sure it did not happen to the soldiers under his care. In this resolve, he was joined by Florimond Duke. The American persuaded the Germans to recognize him formally as the Senior American Officer, SAO, in the camp. As such, he would be party to any confrontation with the commandant. "We'll be two against one," Duke told Todd. These, then, were the two men tasked with steering Colditz through the menacing endgame. Their role, as they saw it, was to protect the prisoners under their command, ensuring that as many as possible survived the war. One afternoon in late August, the men trooped down to the park for an exercise session. For the first time in several months, Michael Sinclair was among them, wearing a large khaki cloak he had bought from a French officer. The guards knew to keep a close watch on the red-headed Sinclair, and sure enough, a routine inspection revealed that beneath his uniform he was wearing homemade civilian clothing. This was plainly preparation for some sort of escape attempt, and Sinclair was duly sentenced to 14 days in solitary. "I was a little hurt that he had told me nothing of any escape plan," wrote Grizz Davis Scarfield. The two men had been the closest friends since the early days of their captivity. They had escaped together from Poznan, hidden out in Poland under the protection of Mrs. M, and plotted each escape together. But in recent months, Sinclair had seemed increasingly unreachable. The death of Sinclair's younger brother at Anzio had deepened his detachment. "Even I, his old friend and comrade, just could not get through to him at all. And to be frank, after a number of rebuffs, I ceased to try very hard." When Davis Scarfield asked what he was up to, Sinclair simply shrugged and said, "You never know when an opportunity might arise." For someone so meticulous in his planning, this too seemed out of character. Sinclair emerged from solitary on the 18th of September. 5 days later, a new notice was posted on the courtyard wall in stark red and black lettering with many exclamation marks, italics, and underlinings. "To all prisoners of war, the escape from prison camps is no longer a sport." The poster accused Britain of deploying gangster commandos, terror bandits, and sabotage troops, and declared, "Germany is determined to safeguard her homeland." This was followed by a threat disguised as a warning. "It has become necessary to create strictly forbidden zones, called death zones, in which all unauthorized trespassers will be immediately shot on sight. escaping prisoners of war entering such death zones will certainly lose their lives. Urgent warning is given against making future escapes. In plain English, stay in the camp where you will be safe. Breaking out of it is now a damn dangerous act. But most prisoners were no longer thinking about escaping. They were thinking about food. Autumn brought with it the first pangs of a great hunger that affected every inhabitant of the castle, both prisoners and guards, gnawing at body and soul alike. The flow of Red Cross parcels had steadily diminished throughout the summer, and stockpiles built up over the previous year were dwindling. In the chaos engulfing the Third Reich, and with rail networks severely disrupted by bombing, supplies were no longer getting through. Those that entered the country from Switzerland were heavily pilfered or vanished long before they reached the camps. Germany was starting to starve. Personal packages from Britain reduced to a trickle and then ceased altogether. Letters from home stopped arriving. Supplementary foodstuffs in Red Cross parcels had made the German rations more palatable and nutritious. Henceforth, the prisoners were increasingly, and soon wholly, reliant on what little the German prison system provided. Mouldy potatoes, black bread and millet, all strictly rationed. A thin and indefinable soup. The few vegetables coming into the castle consisted of turnips and kohlrabi, and those rarely. Todd gave orders to pool the remaining Red Cross packages as an emergency supply. Food had always been a staple topic of castle conversation. It now became all-consuming. On the 25th of September, 2 days after the notice appeared prohibiting escape attempts, Reinhold Eggers stood on the eastern ramparts looking out over the park as the prisoners shuffled into formation for the walk down to the exercise enclosure. It was a beautiful early autumn afternoon. The foliage of the woods was turning, and the first leaves were already falling, dancing across the park on a warm breeze. This was the finest view in Colditz, Eggers reflected, with hornbeams, beeches and sycamores flaming away up through the Tiergarten. The war seemed far away. Grizz Davis Scarfield spotted Mike Sinclair heading down to the park. "I see you're going on the walk. Would you like me to come with you?" he asked. "No, I'd rather be alone, thank you," said Sinclair and turned away. His voice seemed peculiarly deadpan. Nettled, Davis Scarfield thought, "To hell with you. Go for a walk alone if that's what you want." He wandered back up to his room to write a letter home. Davis Scarfield did not spot that beneath the French cloak, his old friend was wearing another set of civilian clothes. The day before, without telling anyone, Sinclair had removed some cash from what was left of the escaper's kitty. Down in the park, the guards took up their positions around the wire fence, 8 feet high and topped with barbed wire. A game of football started. Some of the men relaxed in the autumn sun or chatted in groups, while others strolled around the path worn into the earth just inside the perimeter. Sinclair walked alone for half an hour up and down the wire, and then stopped to watch the game. One of the players looked up and saw that his face was ashen pale. No one noticed when he took a pair of thick black gloves out of his pocket and put them on. It was almost 3 p.m. when Sinclair suddenly whipped off his cloak, jumped over the first tripwire, and began climbing the perimeter fence. For a moment, he seemed to be spread-eagled in mid-air, before he seized the uppermost strand of barbed wire and hauled himself up. He had reached the top, balancing astride the swaying wires, before the German guards understood what was happening. "Halt!" they shouted, unslinging their rifles almost in unison. "Halt oder ich schieße!" "Stop or I'll shoot!" The German NCO on duty that day was one who knew Sinclair and greatly admired him. He unlocked the gate and ran around to the exterior while unholstering his pistol. The game had stopped, and the footballers were now staring in rapt excitement. Sinclair landed hard on the other side, just as the German NCO arrived, panting. "It's no use, Herr Sinclair," he said, not unkindly. Sinclair knocked the man's pistol aside and sprinted up the slope, jinking as he ran, an extraordinarily fixed expression on his face. He was already halfway to the outer wall when the first shot echoed around the park. Then two more, followed by a ragged volley from a dozen guards at different positions on the perimeter. Up in the castle, the prisoners heard the gunfire and shouting and crowded to the windows. "My God, it's Mike," thought Grizz Davis Scarfield. "It must be him." Sinclair was now crouching low and racing towards the tree line. "Nicht schießen," shouted the footballers. "Nicht schießen! Don't shoot!" The machine gun opened up from the emplacement beside the path up to the castle, with a clear line of fire across the little valley. Sinclair was still 10 feet from the outer wall when he staggered and dropped to his knees. The men behind the wire gasped. Then, slowly, he crumpled forward among the autumn leaves. A single bullet had ricocheted off his right elbow directly into his heart. Within the hour, the stunned prisoners were assembled for an emergency roll call in the inner courtyard. The count was held in shocked silence. The German officer of the guard saluted and then solemnly marched his men out through the main gate, leaving the prisoners briefly alone. "Attention," commanded Willie Todd, a prematurely aged man grown suddenly older. "Gentlemen, I am sorry to tell you that Mr. Sinclair is dead." Just 10 prisoners were permitted to attend the funeral at the town cemetery the next day. Commandant Pravitt provided a Union Jack to drape over the coffin, and what everyone agreed was a really lovely wreath. Among Sinclair's possessions, Grizz Davis Scarfield found a note tucked inside a folded shirt. "I take full responsibility. Safe home to you, all you good chaps." The service in the castle chapel had all the familiar cadences of ritual military mourning. "Abide with me, the Lord's my shepherd," and the national anthem. A bugler played the last post from the gallery. Sinclair's achievements were listed. No prisoner had escaped more often or more ardently, or spent so long at liberty inside Germany and Nazi-occupied territory. He had hidden out for months in Poland, protected by a redoubtable Scotswoman. He had reached the borders of Switzerland, Holland, and Bulgaria without ever getting across them. He had been shot through the chest once already while trying to escape. He never gave up. "You know better than any congregation in the world what that means," Padre Platt told the prisoners. "It isn't just a wasteful tragedy," he added, perhaps inadvertently voicing what many were privately wondering. The other prisoners sought to find nobility, significance, and comfort in Sinclair's death. To await freedom at the hands of others would seal his own failure, scar his heart, and sear his soul, said one. Another declared that he was killed through his courage and determination to still try, even after others had given up hope. Grizz Davis Scarfield wondered if the German threat to shoot anyone escaping had acted on Sinclair as an additional spur. Though Todd and Duke issued a formal complaint alleging that Sinclair had been effectively penned in, there were few recriminations against the Germans. The guards had fired reluctantly, after due warning, and certainly without intent to kill, which left the grim but unspoken possibility that Sinclair had meant to get himself killed. Some ascribed his actions to a spontaneous breakdown in reason, but Sinclair was perfectly sane when he died. He knew the most likely outcome of a dive at the wire. Michael Sinclair was 24 when he was captured, and 28 when he died. He had been born into a military family of rigid conformity, for whom dying in battle, as his brother had already done, was the ultimate mark of manhood. Captivity had taken away the certainties he had grown up with. Every failed escape compounded the distance from what he had thought of as his destiny. Perhaps for Sinclair, death from a German bullet on a hillside in Saxony had brought it back. An enemy's tribute means more than all the encomia of comrades. Reinhold Eggers had spent years trying to stop the Red Fox from getting away. He was profoundly moved by Sinclair's death, and reached back into Nordic mythology and his own scholarship for an adequate way to express his feelings. If there is indeed a Valhalla for the heroes of whatever nation, if the men who go there are men of courage and daring, if their determination springs from one true motive alone, and that motive is love of their country, then in our own German tradition, Valhalla is the resting place of Lieutenant Mike Sinclair. "Nerves are on a knife edge," wrote Padre Platt. The daily BBC bulletins brought the promise of victory, but the future of Colditz and its prisoners seemed anything but assured. They might soon be going home. Equally, it seemed quite possible they might be starved to death, taken hostage by the retreating Nazis, or murdered en masse by the SS. In war, preparation is all, but it is hard to organise for the unknown. Colonels Todd and Duke needed information on what might be heading their way, when, and in what form. They needed people on the outside to warn them of the probable fate of those on the inside. If the tables turned and the prisoners seized control of the castle, they needed to know whom they could trust and whom to fear. They needed some reliable intelligence. They needed spies. For months, Irmgard Wernicke had been supplying the escape committee with a variety of useful information. And in the autumn of 1944, Colonel Todd decided to expand intelligence gathering operations in the town. The officer tasked with forming what was now grandly dubbed the Colditz British Intelligence Unit was David Stirling, founder of the SAS and an expert in the use of both cloak and dagger. With the help of Czenek Kalupka, Stirling drew up a shopping list of secrets to be included in the love letters sent to the dentist's assistant. After the necessary fond preludes, the letters turned into questionnaires. The questions dealt with subjects of national interest, morale, attitudes towards the Allies and towards the Nazi Party, but more especially with the situation in Colditz and its surroundings. The location of the police station, the mayor's office, the telephone exchange, the waterworks, barracks of Russian prisoners of war, and main farm buildings. Who were the leading Nazis? Were there any anti-Nazis? By the end of October, Stirling and Cecho were sending Irma two questionnaires a week. Her answers came back carefully thought out and intelligently written. Irma's father knew everyone in the local Nazi party, and she had access to information, both gossip and fact, which could be of great use. She was ready to tell us everything she could. Stirling began to assemble files on the various village notables. Very soon, we had a dossier on all the important local Nazis, not only civilians in the party, but Gestapo and castle administrative personnel. Stirling drew up a map showing where key individuals lived and worked: petrol stores, ammunition dumps, food caches, grain barns, and medicine stocks. The network expanded. The young soldier passing messages back and forth between Irma and Cecho was named Heinz Schmidt. Alert and intelligent, he had been a student at the School of Mining at Freiburg before being conscripted. His father was a local industrialist and one of the richest men in Colditz. But both father and son were secret anti-Nazis. From the start, Heinz knew he was passing on something other than love letters. Irma recruited Heinz, who recruited his father, who then began feeding back information not only about the local Nazi bigwigs, but the names of others who, like him, were ready to work against the regime. The elder Schmidt's willingness to collaborate was partly motivated by revenge. His wife, Heinz's mother, was the mistress of Irma's Nazi father. Infidelity is not unknown in small villages. Rarely, however, does it extend into international espionage. Schmidt confided in other local anti-Nazi elements, recalled Jack Pringle, Sterling's main assistant. Before long, the Colditz British Intelligence Unit had an ideological chart of the locality and a plan to take over the village by force. Pringle wrote, "From information coming from the three of them, we started to select an alternative local government to replace the party and the Gestapo when the end came." If the Third Reich collapsed and the Germans surrendered Colditz to its prisoners, they would know who could be trusted, the name of every important Nazi in a 30-mile radius, and where to find the weapons. When food is short, some hoard, some benefit, and some share. Only a person who has never experienced real hunger believes that he or she would never hide a few secret calories for themselves, or eye a neighbour's crust with avarice. When Red Cross parcels had been plentiful, the prisoners had been content to pool and share resources with their messmates and trade any surplus. But with growing hunger, the internal economy of Colditz altered. The guards, even more famished than the prisoners, were increasingly desperate for the few luxuries remaining in the diminishing stock of Red Cross parcels. The black market boomed, overheated, and then effectively collapsed, gripped by a kind of hyperinflation as tradable goods dwindled. In early December, one prisoner agreed to swap £5 of chocolate and £10 for the promise of a 1938 Renault Coupe, garaged in England. The guards brought in a few fresh eggs, cheese and milk to trade for increasingly scarce items such as coffee, sugar and cigarettes. The nicotine addicts suffered acutely as tobacco supplies steadily decreased. Trading with the guards became so open that Eggers sensibly suggested a barter shop be set up in the courtyard. Pravit was livid. "What do you suggest next? A brothel?" Padre Platt complained bitterly about the boiled kohlrabi, which he described as the bastard offspring of a turnip and a cabbage, and the worst of both. A horse's head, the sort of fare that would once have been disdained, was eagerly boiled and consumed. Enterprising hunters baited hooks on window ledges in the hope of catching an incautious pigeon. In early December, the ration was further reduced to 3 potatoes a day. Platt gloomily described the daily menu. "Breakfast consists of 2 very thin slices of rye bread with a cup of ersatz coffee. Lunch is 1 small potato and 2 or 3 spoonsful of boiled vegetable, followed by 2/7 of a slice of bread and 1/7 of a tin of cheese. The evening meal could be put without difficulty into a 4-ounce tobacco tin." Before Christmas, every prisoner was weighed. All had lost weight, some dramatically so. Grizz Davis Scarfield weighed 11.5 stone before the war. He was now down to 8.75. A diet of just 1,200 calories a day, Julius Green calculated, would ensure loss of weight even if one were just lying in bed all the time. The prisoners began to covet each other's shrinking stocks. Douglas Bader noticed that Green had been saving a small lump of fatty bacon and spotted an opportunity to play the kosher card. "What are you going to do with that bacon, Julius?" "Eat it," the Jewish dentist replied emphatically. "But you're not supposed to." Just you watch me. Where's your principals? Bugger the principals. I'm assuming I have a dispensation from the chief rabbi for the duration of the war. Malnourishment brought with it a new lethargy, as well as aching joints, skin rashes, edema, and searingly bad breath. Enthusiasm for sport tailed off. Games of stoolball all but ceased. On an empty stomach, few were prepared to endure the physical assault inherent in that peculiarly violent game. When bread slices were doled out in fractions, there were opportunities for racketeering, stockpiling desirable foodstuffs and then selling them on at inflated prices. A group of officers broke into the German potato store and began secretly extracting supplies for themselves, prompting outrage and envy. To try to regulate the bartering, Colonel Todd ordered that henceforth only David Sterling and Chenek Kalupka could trade with the Germans, and gave them exclusive access to the emergency stock of Red Cross goods. Anything they managed to obtain would be fairly shared among all the prisoners, including the orderlies. This restriction immediately strengthened the hand of the British intelligence unit, for Cecco and Sterling could use barter to extract additional intelligence from the hungry guards. According to Jack Pringle, they knew just how much information to ask for, how much to offer in exchange in order to coax out more, when to shut off supplies, when to be amiable, when to be tough. But this approach also exacerbated a political divide. Those on the left, like Mickey Byrne, regarded the centralising of food stocks and communal distribution as evidence of egalitarian socialism in action. Others saw it as a suppression of the free market and entrepreneurial enterprise. If a man invested his time and resources in obtaining 6 fresh eggs, should he not be free to enjoy the fruits of his investment? You can't divide 6 eggs between 200 people, pointed out Michael Alexander, who, as a member of the Bullingdon Club and one of the Prominente, had access to many more eggs than the orderlies who polished his shoes. The communist armies were approaching from the east. The forces of capitalist democracy were converging on Germany from the west. As in so much else, life inside Colditz echoed the wider world, a looming ideological confrontation reflected in a fierce debate over the allocation of mouldy potatoes and diluted soup. It was bitterly cold. The coal supply was now insufficient to keep the boilers going, and the castle was frequently freezing. Men slept in multiple layers of clothing. The provision of hot water, never reliable, grew even more erratic. Just before Christmas 1944, the last Red Cross parcel arrived. There would be no more. Food supplies, wrote Eggers, reached their lowest level ever. The strain told in different ways. Some prisoners got blind drunk on the remaining stocks of homemade spirit. The stuff they are drinking is poison, wrote Padre Platt, who nonetheless drank it himself. In spite of the prospect of liberation, or perhaps because of it, some inmates were psychologically overwhelmed by the pressure of waiting. It was not despair that drove a small handful over the edge, but hope. More prisoners than ever are in mental distress, wrote Platt. The kitchen officer was found wandering around the courtyard with a poker in one hand and a wooden spoon in the other, expatiating unintelligibly on Egyptology, military technique, religion, or going north. He was quietly removed by the Germans and sent to an asylum. A few prisoners took to their beds, getting up only to eat. Others buried themselves in books. It is no longer an adventure to get out of this camp, Colonel Todd told the prisoners, a warning that hardly needed to be made in the wake of Sinclair's death. Hungry, cold, and anxious, most of the 254 inmates had already resigned themselves to staying put. Most, but not all. For as the war wound down, a small group of men were hard at work on an escape plan which, for ingenuity and audacity, matched anything that had been attempted before. Climbing or tunnelling out of Colditz was now virtually impossible. Instead, they would try to fly away. Flight Lieutenant Bill Goldfinch was watching the snowflakes floating up and over the roof of the castle when he had an aerodynamic brainwave. The same air currents causing the flakes to fall upwards might be sufficient to keep a manned glider aloft as far as the opposite side of the Mulder River, 200 yards away, where a wide patch of meadow would make a potential landing strip. The glider would have to be built in secrecy in one of the attics. When the time was right, the escapers would break through a wall, assemble the aircraft on the roof, and then lay a 60-foot launch strip along the ridgeline of the roof immediately below, out of view of the sentries. A sheet rope would be attached to the nose of the glider, running over a pulley wheel at the end of the platform, secured at the other end to a bath filled with concrete and weighing roughly 1 ton. In theory, when this weight was dropped from the third floor of the chapel block to the ground 60 feet below, it would pull the glider and its two occupants along the runway and then fling the aircraft into the sky with sufficient momentum to become airborne. There were, however, a number of obstacles to this plan. The glider would require a wingspan of 33 feet. The western side of the castle was heavily guarded. Once launched, the glider would be visible to both sentries on the ramparts and inhabitants of the village, and an easy target. The physics were not reliable either. To achieve the required lift, the westerly wind would need to be blowing in exactly the right direction at the correct speed. The glider would have to take off during an air raid when the blackout was in force, cross over the river, and land in darkness. If the rope did not detach at the critical moment, the heavy bath would drag the glider over the edge and send it plummeting to earth at lethal velocity. If it rained, the glue holding it together would dissolve and the aircraft would disintegrate. The glider was nicknamed the Colditz Cock. A cockerel cannot fly, but launched from a height, it can glide a short distance. The Colditz glider was a tour de force of inventiveness, a remarkable combination of lateral thinking, technical creativity, and collective endeavour. It was also extremely unlikely to work. Colonel Todd was fully aware of this when he approved the plan, but he also knew this wildly ambitious project would give the men something to do and think about, forge a fresh spirit of cohesion, and take their minds off the hunger. It would require more than 6,000 individual pieces of wood, metal bolts extracted from bed frames, stolen telephone cabling for the controls, a covering stitched out of blue and white mattress covers, and several pints of glue. It would take a long time to make and involve scores of prisoners as designers, builders, and stooges. The war would probably have ended by the time it was ready for takeoff, and that, perhaps, was the point. Whether the Colditz glider would ever be launched was, in the end, secondary. This might be the greatest escape never attempted. The other members of the glider team were the former Ghost, Jack Best, and Tony Rolt, an engineer and champion racing driver who had won the British Empire Trophy in 1939. It was agreed that not until just before takeoff would they draw lots to decide which pair would board the glider for its one and only flight. The prison library included a copy of Aircraft Design by Cecil Latimer Needham, the British gliding pioneer and aircraft engineer who also invented the hovercraft skirt. With the help of this seminal text, Goldfinch and Best drew up plans for a lightweight, two-seater, high-wing monoplane glider, 20 feet long with rudder and elevators. Its 30 ribs would be carved from wooden bed slats. The four wing spars would be fashioned from floorboards. The pores in the cloth covering would be sealed with a dope made from boiled millet to form a semi-rigid outer skin. The design drawings and stress calculations were checked and approved by Lorne Welsh, an engineer at the Royal Aircraft Establishment who had flown gliders before the war. At the western end of the topmost attic above the chapel, the team constructed a false wall from wood and canvas caked with dust to create a secret workshop, accessible from below through a concealed trapdoor. The guards inspected the attic irregularly. They failed to spot that the room had become 7 feet shorter. The builders installed a workbench, electric light, and a set of homemade tools, including planes, a gauge made from a cupboard bolt, and a tiny saw fashioned out of a gramophone spring for detailed cutting. Cecho Kalupka obtained glue on the black market. Construction had started in the summer of 1944. Takeoff was planned for the following spring. Throughout that winter, 12 engineers, calling themselves the Apostles, worked on the glider, steaming and bending the wood, pinning, gluing, silently hammering, drilling, cutting, and stitching the outer fabric and daubing it with the millet dope to draw the material tight around the frame. Some 40 lookouts worked in shifts to warn if guards approached. At least a quarter of all the prisoners in Colditz would be involved in the building of the secret glider, the most elaborate collective construction project since the Great French Tunnel of 1942. By mid-December, the builders had assembled the fuselage, wings, rudder, ropes, pulleys, and most of the saddle boards that would be secured along the apex of the roof to form a runway. Colonel Todd made an inspection of the secret workshop and was profoundly moved by the industry and determination of the builders. The glider might never fly, but something magical was taking flight beneath the eaves of Colditz. Christmas that year was the strangest, the sparsest, and the most sober. Cecho Kalupka honoured the wager he had made after D-Day and ran naked around the snowy courtyard 3 times, cheered on by a boisterous gallery of muffled-up spectators. The spectacle would have been funnier had it not been proof that predictions of an early end to the war were hopelessly optimistic. A Christmas draw was held for the few remaining Red Cross food items, the most coveted being a 2-pound tin of pork and beans. Platt's mess of 8 men drew 3 small tins of sardines, a tin of golden syrup, and some oatmeal. There was only 1 small drinking party, the padre noted approvingly, and I don't believe they had enough alcohol to get tight. A Christmas pantomime, Hey Diddle Snow White, was staged in the Icy Theatre, produced by Captain the Earl of Hopeton, who also played the Fairy Queen. Christmas in the German quarters was even more frugal. Yet Eggers detected a momentary happiness within the guard company, now made up of middle-aged men and boys barely out of their teens. It must all soon be over, he reflected. Hitler's New Year speech was simply a call to fight on. Despite the grinding hunger and intense cold, Platt also noticed a peculiarly festive air among the prisoners. It is amazing to hear everyone describing this, the Christmas they most hated the thought of spending in Germany, as the best they have spent here. One reason for that was the flying machine taking magnificent shape in the attic. For the glider was more than just an elaborate escape tool. It was a dream, a flight of near fantasy that could take the prisoners' imaginations soaring over and beyond the castle walls. The glider was an object of faith, a beautiful blue and white gingham-clad symbol of hope, built from stolen bedboards and coated in old porridge.